Side 2, Rising Sun by Michael Crichton, continuing on page 46. I started to ask another question, but Connor raised his hand. I imagine, Mr. Phillips, you must have been pretty surprised when you came in this room at 8:45.
You damn right I was, Phillips said.
What did you do when you saw the situation?
Well, right away I said to the guy, can I help you?
Very polite, but still firm. I mean, this is the security room, and I don't know who this guy is. I've never seen him before. And the guy is tense, very tense. He says to me, get out of my way. Real pushy, like he owns the world. And he shoves past me, taking his briefcase with him. I say, excuse me, sir, I'll have to see some identification. He don't answer me, he just keeps going, out the lobby and down the stairs.
You didn't try and stop him?
No, sir, I didn't.
Because he was Japanese?
You got that right. But I called up to Central Security, it's up on the 9th floor, to say I found a man in the room. And they say, don't worry, everything is fine. But I can hear they're tense, too. Everybody is tense. And then I see on the monitor, the dead girl. So that's the first I knew what it was about.
Connor said, the man you saw, can you describe him?
The guard shrugged.
30, 35, medium height, dark blue suit like they all wear. Actually, he was more hip than most of them. He had this tie with triangles on it.
Oh, and a scar on his hand, like a burn or something.
Which hand?
The left hand. I noticed it when he was closing the briefcase.
Could you see inside the briefcase?
No.
But he was closing it when you came in the room?
Yes.
Was it your impression he took something from this room?
I really couldn't say, sir.
Phillips's evasiveness began to annoy me. I said, what do you think he took?
Connor shot me a look. The guard went bland.
I really don't know, sir.
Connor said, of course you don't. There's no way you could know what was in somebody else's briefcase. By the way, do you make recordings from the security cameras here?
Yes, we do.
Could you show me how you do that?
Sure thing.
The guard got up from the desk and opened a door at the far end of the room. We followed him into a second small room, almost closet, stacked floor to ceiling with small metal boxes, each with stenciled notations in Japanese kanji script, and numbers in English, each with a glowing red light and an LED counter with numbers running forward. Phillips said, these are our recorders. They lay down signals from all the cameras in the building. They're 8mm high-definition black and white. He held up a small cassette, like an audio cassette. Each one of these records 8 hours. We change over at 9 p.m., so that's the first thing I do when I come on duty. I pop out the old ones and switch over to the fresh ones.
And did you change cassettes tonight at 9 o'clock?
Yes, sir, just like always.
And what do you do with the tapes you remove?
Keep them in the trays down here, he said, bending to show us several long, thin drawers. We keep everything off the cameras for 72 hours. That's 3 days. So we keep 9 sets of tapes all together, and we just rotate each set through once every 3 days. Get me?
Connor hesitated. Perhaps I'd better write this down.
He produced a small pad and pen. Now, each tape lasts 8 hours, so you have 9 different sets.
Right, right.
Connor wrote for a moment, then shook his pen irritably.
This damn pen. It's out of ink. You have a wastebasket?
Phillips pointed to the corner.
Over there?
Thank you. Connor threw the pen away. I gave him mine. He resumed his notes.
You were saying, Mr. Phillips, that you have 9 sets.
Right. Each set is numbered with letters from A to I. Now when I come in at 9, I eject the tapes and see whatever letter is already in there and put in the next one. Like tonight, I took out set C, so I put in set D, which is what's recording now.
I see, Connor said. And then you put tape set C in one of the drawers here?
Right. He pulled open a drawer. This one here.
Connor said, may I?
He glanced at the neatly labeled rows of tapes. Then he quickly opened the other drawers and looked at the other stacks of tapes.
Except for the different letters, all the drawers looked identical.
I think I understand now, Connor said. What you actually do is use 9 sets in rotation.
Exactly.
So each set gets used once every 3 days.
Right.
And how long has the security office been using this system?
The building's new, but we've been going, maybe 2 months now.
I must say it's a very well-organized system, Connor said appreciatively. Thank you for explaining it to us. I have only a couple of other questions.
Sure.
First of all, these counters here, Connor said, pointing to the LED counters on the video recorders. They seem to show the elapsed time since the tapes began recording. Is that right? Because it's now almost 11 o'clock, and you put in the tapes at 9, and the top recorder says 1:55:30, and the next recorder says 1:55:10, and so on.
Yes, that's right. I put the tapes in one right after another. It takes a few seconds between tapes.
I see. These all show almost 2 hours, but I noticed that one recorder down here shows an elapsed time of only 30 minutes. Does that mean it's broken?
Huh, Philip said, frowning. I guess maybe it is, because I changed the tapes all one after another, like I said. But these recorders are the latest technology. Sometimes there are glitches, or we had some power problems. Could be that.
Yes, quite possibly, Connor said. Can you tell me which camera is hooked to this recorder?
Yes, of course.
Phillips read the number off the recorder and went out to the main room with the monitor screens.
It's camera 46/6, he said. This view here.
He tapped the screen. It was an atrium camera, and it showed an overall view of the 46th floor.
But you see, Phillips said, the beauty of the system is, even if one recorder screws up, there are still other cameras on that floor, and the video recorders on the others seem to be working okay.
Yes, they do, Connor said. By the way, can you tell me why there are so many cameras on the 46th floor?
You didn't hear it from me, Philip said, but you know how they like efficiency. The word is, they are going to Kaizen the office workers.
So basically, these cameras have been installed to observe workers during the day and help them improve their efficiency?
That's what I heard.
Well, I think that's it, Connor said.
Oh, one more question. Do you have an address for Ted Cole?
Philip shook his head.
No, I don't.
Have you ever been out with him, socialized with him?
I have, but not much. He's an odd guy.
Ever been to his apartment?
No, he's kind of secretive. I think he lives with his mother or something. We usually go to this bar, the Palomino, over by the airport. He likes it there.
Connor nodded.
And one last question. Where is the nearest payphone?
Out in the lobby and around to your right, by the restrooms. But you're welcome to use the phone here.
Connor shook the guard's hand warmly.
Mr. Phillips, I appreciate your taking the time to talk to us.
No problem.
I gave the guard my card. If you think of anything later that could help us, Mr. Phillips, don't hesitate to call me. And I left. Connor stood at the payphone in the lobby. It was one of those new standing booths that has 2 receivers, one on either side, allowing 2 people to talk on the same line at once. These booths had been installed in Tokyo years ago and now were starting to show up all over Los Angeles. Of course, Pacific Bell no longer was the principal provider of American public payphones. Japanese manufacturers had penetrated that market, too. I watched Connor write down the phone number in his notebook.
What are you doing?
We have 2 separate questions to answer tonight. One is how the girl came to be killed on an office floor. But we also need to find out who placed the original call, notifying us of the murder.
And you think the call might have been placed from this phone?
Possibly.
He closed his notebook and glanced at his watch.
It's late. We better get going.
I think we're making a big mistake here.
Why is that? Connor asked.
I don't know if we should leave the tapes in that security room. What if somebody switches them while we're gone?
They've already been switched, Connor said.
How do you know?
I gave up a perfectly good pen to find out, he said.
Now, come on.
He started walking toward the stairs leading down to the garage. I followed him. "You see," Connor said, "when Phillips first explained that simple system of rotation, it was immediately clear to me that there might have been a switch. The question was how to prove it." His voice echoed in the concrete stairwell. Connor continued down, taking the steps two at a time. I hurried to keep up. Connor said, "If somebody switched the tapes, how would they go about it? They would be working hastily under pressure. They'd be terrified of making a mistake. They certainly wouldn't want to leave any incriminating tapes behind. So probably they'd switch an entire set and replace it. But replace it with what? They can't just put in the next set. Since there are only 9 sets of tapes altogether, it would be too easy for someone to notice that one set was missing, and the total was now 8. There would be an obvious empty drawer. No, they would have to replace the set they were taking away with an entirely new set. 20 brand new tapes. And that meant I ought to check the trash."
"That's why you threw your pen away?"
"Yes, I didn't want Phillips to know what I was doing."
"And?"
"The trash was full of crumpled plastic wrappers, the kind that new videotapes come wrapped in."
"I see."
"Once I knew the tapes had been replaced, the only remaining question was, which set? So I played dumb and looked in all the drawers. You probably noticed that set C, the set Phillips removed when he came on duty, had slightly whiter labels than the other sets. It was subtle, because the office has only been active 2 months. But you could tell."
"I see."
"Somebody had come into the security room, taken out 20 fresh tapes, unwrapped them, written new labels, and popped them into the video machines, replacing the original tapes that had recorded the murder." I said, "If you ask me, Phillips knows more about this than he was telling us."
"Maybe," Connor said,
"but we have more important things to do. Anyway, there's a limit to what he knows. The murder was phoned in about 8:30. Phillips arrived at 8:45, so he never saw the murder. We can assume the previous guard, Cole, did. But by 8:45, Cole was gone, and an unknown Japanese man was in the security room, closing up a briefcase."
"You think he's the one who switched the tapes?"
Connor nodded. "Very possibly. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if this man was the killer himself. I hope to find that out at Miss Austin's apartment."
He threw open the door, and we went into the garage.
A line of party guests waited for valets to bring their cars. I saw Ishigura chatting up Mayor Thomas and his wife. Connor steered me toward them. Standing alongside the mayor, Ishigura was so cordial he was almost obsequious. He gave us a big smile.
"Ah, gentlemen, is your investigation proceeding satisfactorily? Is there anything more I can do to help?"
I didn't get really angry until that moment, until I saw the way he toadied up in front of the mayor. It made me so mad I began to turn red. But Connor took it in stride. "Thank you, Ishigura-san," he said with a slight bow. "The investigation is going well."
"You're receiving all the help you requested?" Ishigura said.
"Oh, yes," Connor said. "Everyone has been very cooperative."
"Good, good.
I'm glad." Ishigura glanced at the mayor and smiled at him, too. He was all smiles, it seemed. "But," Connor said, "there is just one thing."
"Just name it, if there is anything we can do."
"The security tapes seem to have been removed."
"Security tapes?"
Ishigura frowned, clearly caught off guard.
"Yes,"
Connor said. "Recordings from the security cameras."
"I don't know anything about that," Ishigura said. "But let me assure you, if any tapes exist, they are yours to examine."
"Thank you," Connor said. "Unfortunately, it seems the crucial tapes have been removed from the Nakamoto security office."
"Removed? Gentlemen, I believe there must be some mistake."
The mayor was watching this exchange closely. Connor said, "Perhaps, but I don't think so. It would be reassuring, Mr. Ishigura, if you were to look into this matter yourself."
"I certainly will," Ishigura said.
"But I must say again, I can't imagine, Captain Connor, that any tapes are missing." "Thank you for checking, Mr. Ishigura," Connor said.
"Not at all, Captain," he said, still smiling. "It is my pleasure to assist you in whatever way I can."
"The son of a bitch," I said.
We were driving west on the Santa Monica Freeway.
The little prick looked us right in the eye and lied.
It's annoying, Connor said. But you see, Ishigura takes a different view. Now that he is beside the mayor, he sees himself in another context, with another set of obligations and requirements for his behavior. Since he is sensitive to context, he's able to act differently, with no reference to his earlier behavior. To us, he seems like a different person, but Ishigura feels he's just being appropriate.
What burns me is he acted so confident.
Of course he did, Connor said. And he would be quite surprised to learn that you are angry with him. You consider him immoral. He considers you naive. Because for a Japanese, consistent behavior is not possible. A Japanese becomes a different person around people of different rank. He becomes a different person when he moves through different rooms of his own house. Yeah, I said, that's fine. But the fact is, he's a lying son of a bitch. Connor looked at me.
Would you talk that way to your mother?
Of course not.
So you change according to context, too, Connor said.
The fact is, we all do. It's just that Americans believe there is some core of individuality that doesn't change from one moment to the next. And the Japanese believe context rules everything.
It sounds to me, I said, like an excuse for lying.
He doesn't see it as lying. But that's what it is. Connor shrugged. Only from your point of view, Kohai. Not from his.
The hell.
Look, it's your choice. You can understand the Japanese and deal with them as they are, or you can get pissed off. But our problem in this country is that we don't deal with the Japanese the way they really are.
The car hit a deep pothole, bouncing so hard that the car phone fell off the receiver. Connor picked it up off the floor and put it back on the hook. Up ahead, I saw the exit for Bundy. I moved into the right lane.
One thing I'm not clear about, I said. Why do you think the man with the briefcase in the security room might be the killer?
It's because of the time sequence. You see, the murder was reported at 8:32. Less than 15 minutes later, at 8:45, a Japanese man was down there switching the tapes, arranging a cover-up. That's a very fast response. Much too fast for a Japanese company.
Why is that?
Japanese organizations are actually very slow to respond in a crisis. Their decision-making relies on precedents, and when a situation is unprecedented, people are uncertain how to behave. You remember the faxes? I am sure faxes have been flying back and forth to Nakamoto's Tokyo headquarters all night. Undoubtedly, the company is still trying to decide what to do. A Japanese organization simply cannot move fast in a new situation.
But an individual acting alone can?
Yes, exactly.
I said, and that's why you think the man with the briefcase may be the killer.
Connor nodded. Yes, either the killer or someone closely connected with the killer. But we should learn more at Miss Austin's apartment. I believe I see it up ahead on the right.
The Imperial Arms was an apartment building on a tree-lined street a kilometer from Westwood Village. Its fake Tudor beams needed a paint job, and the whole building had a run-down appearance. But that was not unusual in this middle-class section of apartments inhabited by graduate students and young families. In fact, the chief characteristic of the Imperial Arms seemed to be its anonymity. You could drive by the building every day and never notice it.
Perfect, Connor said as we walked up the steps to the entrance. It's just what they like.
What who likes? We came into the lobby, which had been renovated in the most bland California style. Pastel wallpaper with a flower print, overstuffed couches, cheap ceramic lamps, and a chrome coffee table. The only thing to distinguish it from 100 other apartment lobbies was the security desk in the corner, where a heavy-set Japanese doorman looked up from his comic book with a distinctly unfriendly manner.
Help you?
Connor showed his badge. He asked where Cheryl Austin's apartment was.
I announce you, the doorman said, reaching for the phone.
Don't bother.
No, I announce. Maybe she have company now.
I'm sure she doesn't, Connor said.
Karewa, keisatsu no shigotu da.
He was saying we were on official police business. The doorman gave a tense bow.
Heya, bango wa kudas.
He handed Connor a key. We went through a second glass door and down a carpeted corridor. There were small lacquer tables at each end of the corridor, and in its simplicity, the interior was surprisingly elegant. Typically Japanese, Connor said with a smile. I thought, a run-down, fake Tudor apartment building in Westwood? Typically Japanese? From a room to the left, I heard faint rap music, the latest hammer hit.
It's because the outside gives no clue to the inside, Connor explained. That's a fundamental principle of Japanese thinking. The public facade is unrevealing. In architecture, the human face, everything. It's always been that way. You look at old samurai houses in Takayama or Kyoto. You can't tell anything from the outside. This is a Japanese building? Of course. Why else would a Japanese national who hardly speaks English be the doorman? And he is a yakuza. You probably noticed the tattoo. I hadn't. The yakuza were Japanese gangsters. I didn't know there were yakuza here in America and said so. You must understand, Connor said, there is a shadow world. Here in Los Angeles, in Honolulu, in New York. Most of the time you're never aware of it. We live in our regular American world, walking on our American streets, and we never notice that right alongside our world is a second world. Very discreet, very private. Perhaps in New York you will see Japanese businessmen walking through an unmarked door and catch a glimpse of a club behind. Perhaps you will hear of a small sushi bar in Los Angeles that charges $1,200 a person, Tokyo prices. But they are not listed in the guidebooks. They are not a part of our American world. They are part of the shadow world, available only to the Japanese. And this place? This is a beteku, a love residence where mistresses are kept. And here is Miss Austin's apartment. Connor unlocked the door with the key the doorman had given him. We went inside. It was a two-bedroom unit, furnished with expensive oversized rental pieces in pastel pink and green. The oil paintings on the walls had been rented, too. A label on the side of one frame said, Brunner's Rents. The kitchen counter was bare, except for a bowl of fruit. The refrigerator contained only yogurt and cans of Diet Coke. The couches in the living room didn't look as if anybody had ever sat on them. On the coffee table was a picture book of Hollywood star portraits and a vase of dried flowers. Empty ashtrays scattered around. One of the bedrooms had been converted to a den, with a couch and a television and an exercise bike in the corner. Everything was brand new. The television still had a sticker that said, Digital Tuning Feature, diagonally across one corner. The handlebars of the exercise bike were covered in plastic wrap. In the master bedroom, I finally found some human clutter. One mirrored closet door stood open, and three expensive party dresses were thrown across the bed. Evidently, she had been trying to decide what to wear. On the dresser top were bottles of perfume, a diamond necklace, a gold Rolex, framed photographs, and an ashtray with stubbed-out mild 7 menthol cigarettes. The top dresser drawer, containing panties and undergarments, was partially open. I saw her passport stuck in the corner and thumbed through it. There was one visa for Saudi Arabia, one for Indonesia, and three entry stamps for Japan. The stereo in the corner was still turned on, and ejected tape in the player. I pushed it in, and Jerry Lee Lewis sang, You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain, too much love drives a man insane. Texas music. Too old for a young girl like this. But maybe she liked golden oldies. I turned back to the dresser. Several framed color enlargements showed Cheryl Austin smiling in front of Asian backgrounds. The red gates of a shrine, a formal garden, a street with gray skyscrapers, a train station. The pictures seemed to be taken in Japan. In most of the pictures, Cheryl was alone, but in a few she was accompanied by an older Japanese man with glasses and a receding hairline. A final shot showed her in what looked like the American West. Cheryl was standing near a dusty pickup truck, smiling beside a frail, grandmotherly woman in sunglasses. The older woman wasn't smiling and looked uncomfortable.
Tucked in beside the dresser were several large paper rolls, standing on end. I opened one. It was a poster showing Cheryl in a bikini, smiling and holding up a bottle of Asahi beer. All the writing on the poster was in Japanese. I went into the bathroom. I saw a pair of jeans kicked in the corner, a white sweater tossed on the countertop, a wet towel on a hook by the shower stall, beads of water inside the stall, electric hair curlers unplugged by the counter. Stuck in the mirror frame, photos of Cheryl standing with another Japanese man on the Malibu Pier. This man was in his mid-30s and handsome. In one photograph, he had draped his arm familiarly over her shoulder. I could clearly see the scar on his hand. "Bingo," I said. Connor came into the room. "Find something?" "Our man with the scar." "Good." Connor studied the picture carefully. I looked back at the clutter of the bathroom, the stuff around the sink. "You know," I said, "something bothers me about this place."
"What's that?"
"I know she hasn't lived here long, and I know everything is rented. But still, I can't get over the feeling that this place has a contrived look. I can't quite put my finger on why." Connor smiled. "Very good, Lieutenant. It does have a contrived look, and there's a reason for it." He handed me a Polaroid photo. It showed the bathroom we were standing in, the jeans kicked in the corner, the towel hanging, the curlers on the counter. But it was taken with one of those ultra-wide-angle cameras that distort everything. The SID team sometimes used them for evidence. "Where did you get this?" "From the trash bin in the hall, by the elevators."
"So it must have been taken earlier tonight."
"Yes. Notice anything different about the room?" I examined the Polaroid carefully. "No, it looks the same. Wait a minute. Those pictures stuck in her mirror. They aren't in the Polaroid. Those pictures have been added."
"Exactly."
Connor walked back into the bedroom. He picked up one of the framed pictures on the dresser. "Now look at this one," he said. "Miss Austin and a Japanese friend in Shinjuku Station in Tokyo. She was probably drawn to the Kabukicho section. Or perhaps she was just shopping. Notice the right-hand edge of the picture. See the narrow strip that's lighter in color?"
"Yes."
And I understood what that strip meant. There had been another picture on top of this one. The edge of this picture had stuck out and was sun-faded. "The overlying picture has been removed."
"Yes," Connor said.
"The apartment has been searched."
"Yes,"
Connor said. "A very thorough job. They came in earlier tonight, took Polaroids, searched the rooms, and then put things back the way they were. But it's impossible to do that exactly. The Japanese say artlessness is the most difficult art. And these men can't help themselves. They're obsessive. So they leave the picture frames a little too squared off on the counter, and the perfume bottles a little too carefully cluttered. Everything is a little forced. Your eye can see it, even if your brain doesn't register it." I said, "But why search the room? What pictures did they remove? Her with the killer?"
"That's not clear," Connor said. Evidently, her association with Japan and with Japanese men was not objectionable. But there was something they had to get right away. And it can only be...
Then from the living room, a tentative voice said,
"Lynn? Honey? You here?"
She was silhouetted in the doorway, looking in, barefooted, wearing shorts and a tank top. I couldn't see her face well, but she was obviously what my old partner Anderson would call a snake charmer. Connor showed his badge. She said her name was Julia Young. She had a southern accent and a slight slur to her speech. Connor turned on the light and we could see her better. She was a beautiful girl. She came into the room hesitantly.
"I heard the music. Is she here? Is Cheryl Lynn okay? I know she went to that party tonight."
"I haven't heard anything," Connor said, with a quick glance at me. "Do you know Cheryl Lynn?"
"Well, sure. I live right across the hall in number 8. Why is everybody in her room?"
"Everybody?"
"Well, you two, and the two Japanese guys."
"When were they here?"
"I don't know. Maybe half an hour ago. Is it something about Cheryl Lynn?"
I said,
Did you get a look at the man, Miss Young?
I was thinking she might have been looking out of the peephole of her door.
Well, I guess. I said hello to them. How's that? I know one of them pretty well. Eddie.
Eddie?
Eddie Sakamura. We all know Eddie. Fast Eddie.
I said, can you describe him?
She gave me a funny look. He's the guy in the pictures. The young guy with the scar on his hand. I thought everybody knew Eddie Sakamura. He's in the newspaper all the time, charities and stuff. He's a big party guy.
I said, do you have any idea how I could find him? Connor said, Eddie Sakamura is part owner of a Polynesian restaurant in Beverly Hills called Bora Bora. He hangs out there.
That's him, Julia said. That place is like his office. I can't stand it myself. It's too noisy. But Eddie's just running around chasing those big blondes. He loves to look up to a girl.
She leaned against a table and pushed her full brown hair back from her face seductively. She looked at me and gave a little pout.
You two guys partners?
Yes, I said.
He showed me his badge, but you didn't show me yours.
I took out my wallet. She looked at it.
Peter,
she said, reading.
My very first boyfriend was named Peter, but he wasn't as handsome as you.
She smiled at me. Connor cleared his throat and said, have you been in Cheryl Lynn's apartment before?
Well, I guess. I live right across the way. But she hasn't been in town much lately. Seems like she's always traveling.
Traveling where?
All over. New York, Washington, Seattle, Chicago, all over. She has this boyfriend who travels a lot. She meets him. Actually, I think she just meets him when his wife isn't around.
This boyfriend is married?
Well, there's something in the way. You know, obstructing.
Do you know who he is?
No. She once said he'd never come to her apartment. He's some big important guy, real rich. They send the jet for her, and off she goes. Whoever he is, he drives Eddie crazy. But Eddie is the jealous type, you know. Got to be Iro Otoko to all the girls. The sexy lover.
Connor said, is Cheryl's relationship a secret with this boyfriend?
I don't know. I never thought it was. It's just real intense. She's madly in love with the guy.
She's madly in love?
You can't imagine. I've seen her drop everything to run and meet him. One night she comes over, gives me two tickets to the Springsteen concert. But she's all excited because she's going to Detroit. She's got her little carry-on in her hand. She's got her little nice girl dress on. Because he just called 10 minutes ago and said, meet me. Her face all bright. She looks about 5 years old. I don't know why she can't figure it out.
Figure what out?
This guy is just using her.
Why do you say that?
Cheryl Lynn is beautiful and real sophisticated looking. She's worked all over the world as a model, mostly in Asia. But deep down, she's a small town girl. I mean, Midland is an oil town. There's lots of money, but it's still a small town. And Cheryl Lynn wants the ring on the finger and the kids and the dog in the yard. And this guy isn't going to do it. She hasn't figured it out.
I said, but you don't know who this man is.
No, I don't.
A sly look crossed her face. She shifted her body, dropping one shoulder so her breasts thrust forward.
But you're not really here because of some old boyfriend, are you?
Connor nodded. Not really, no. Julia smiled in a knowing way.
It's Eddie, isn't it?
Connor said.
I knew it, she said. I knew he'd get in trouble sooner or later. We all talked about it, all the girls here in the arms.
She made a vague gesture.
Because he's just going too fast. Fast Eddie. You wouldn't think he was Japanese. He's so flashy.
Connor said, he's from Osaka?
His father's a big industrialist there, with Daimashi. He's a nice old guy. When he comes over to visit, sometimes he sees one of the girls on the second floor. And Eddie. Eddie was supposed to get educated here for a few years, then go home to work for the Kaisha, the company. But he won't go home. He loves it here. Why not? He's got everything. He buys a new Ferrari every time he bangs up the old one. He's got more money than God. He's lived here long enough. He's just like an American. handsome, sexy, and with all the drugs. You know, real party animal. What's in Osaka for him?
I said,
but you said you always knew
that he'd get in trouble?
Sure, because of that crazy side, that edge.
She shrugged.
A lot of them have it. These guys come over from Tokyo, and even if they have a shokai, an introduction, you still have to be careful. They think nothing of dropping 10 or 20,000 in a night. It's like a tip for them. Leave it on the dresser. But then, what they want to do, at least some of them.
She drifted into silence. Her eyes had a vacant, unfocused look. I didn't say anything. I just waited. Connor was looking at her, nodding sympathetically.
Abruptly, she began to speak again, as if unaware of the pause. And to them, she said, their wishes, their desires, it's just as natural as leaving the tip. It's completely natural to them. I mean, I don't mind a little golden shower or whatever, handcuffs, you know, maybe a little spanking if I like the guy. But I won't let anybody cut me. I don't care how much money. None of those things with knives or swords. But they can be. A lot of them, they are so polite, so correct. But then they get turned on. They have this way.
She broke off, shaking her head.
They're strange people.
Connor glanced at his watch.
Miss Young, you've been very helpful. We may need to speak to you again. Lieutenant Smith will take your phone number.
Yes, of course.
I flipped open my pad. Connor said, I'm going to have a word with the doorman.
Shinichi, she said.
Connor left. I took down Julia's number. She licked her lips as she watched me write. Then she said,
you can tell me. Did he kill her?
Who?
Eddie. Did he kill Cheryl Lynn?
She was a pretty girl, but I could see the excitement in her eyes. She was looking at me with a steady gaze. Her eyes were shining. It was creepy. I said,
why do you ask? Because he was always threatening to. Like this afternoon, he threatened her.
I said, Eddie was here this afternoon?
Sure.
She shrugged.
He's here all the time. He came to see her this afternoon, real worked up. They put extra soundproofing to the walls in this building when they took it over. But even so, you could hear them scream at each other in her apartment. Him and Cheryl Lynn. She'd have on her Jerry Lee Lewis, the one she played day and night until you just about went crazy, and they'd be screaming and throwing things. He'd always say, I'll kill you, you bitch. So, did he?
I don't know.
But she's dead?
Her eyes still shining.
Yes. It had to happen, she said.
She seemed completely calm.
We all knew it. It was just a matter of time. If you want, call me if you need more information.
Yes, I will.
I gave her my card. And if you think of anything else, you can call me at this number. She slipped it into the hip pocket of her shorts, twisting her body.
I like talking to you, Peter.
Yes.
Okay. I walked down the corridor. When I got to the end, I looked back. She was standing in her doorway, waving goodbye. Connor was using the phone in the lobby while the doorman stared sullenly at him as if he wanted to stop him, but couldn't think of a reason why.
That's right, Connor was saying. All the outgoing calls from that phone between 8 and 10 p.m.
That's right. He listened for a moment.
Well, I don't care if your data isn't organized that way. Just get it for me.
How long will it take?
Tomorrow? Don't be ridiculous. What do you think this is? I need it within 2 hours.
I'll call you back. Yes, fuck you too. He hung up. Let's go, Kohai. We walked outside to the car. I said, checking your contacts?
Contacts?
He looked puzzled. Oh, Graham said something to you about my contacts.
I don't have any special informants. He just thinks I do.
He mentioned the Arakawa case.
Connor sighed. That old thing. We walked toward the car.
You want to know that story? It's simple.
Two Japanese nationals get killed. The department puts detectives on the case who can't speak Japanese. Finally, after a week, they give the case to me.
And what did you do?
The Arakawas were staying at the new Otani Hotel. I got the phone records of the calls they made to Japan. I called those numbers and spoke to some people in Osaka. Then I called Osaka and talked to the police there. Again in Japanese. They were surprised to hear we didn't know the whole story.
I see. Not quite, Connor said. Because the police department here was very embarrassed. The press had gone out on a limb, criticizing the department. All sorts of people had sent flowers. There had been a big show of sympathy for what turned out to be gangsters. A lot of people were embarrassed. So the whole thing became my fault. I had done something underhanded to solve the case. Pissed me off, I can tell you.
That's why you went to Japan?
No, that's another story.
We came to the car. I looked back at the Imperial Arms and saw Julia Young standing at the window staring down at us.
She's seductive, I said.
The Japanese call women like that shirigaruona. They say she has a light ass.
He opened the car door and got in. But she's on drugs. We can't trust anything she told us. Even so, there's starting to be a pattern I don't like.
He glanced at his watch and shook his head. Damn, we're taking too long. We'd better go to the Palomino to see Mr. Cole.
I started driving south toward the airport. Connor sat back in his seat and folded his arms across his chest. He stared at his feet, looking unhappy.
Why do you say there's a pattern you don't like?
Connor said, the wrappers in the wastebasket, the Polaroid in the trash. Those things shouldn't have been left behind.
You said yourself they're in a hurry.
Maybe. But you know the Japanese think American police are incompetent. This sloppiness is a sign of their disdain.
Well, we're not incompetent.
Connor shook his head. Compared to the Japanese, we are incompetent. In Japan, every criminal gets caught. For major crimes, convictions run 99%. So any criminal in Japan knows from the outset he is going to get caught. But here, the conviction rate is more like 17%. Not even one in five. So a criminal in the States knows he probably isn't going to get caught. And if he's caught, he won't be convicted, thanks to all his legal safeguards. And you know every study of police effectiveness shows that American detectives either solve the case in the first 6 hours, or they never solve it at all.
So what are you saying?
I'm saying that a crime occurred here with the expectation that it won't be solved. And I want to solve it, Kohai.
Connor was silent for the next 10 minutes. He sat very still, with his arms folded and his chin sunk on his chest. His breathing was deep and regular. I might have thought he had fallen asleep, except his eyes were open. I just drove the car and listened to him breathe. Finally, he said, Ishigura.
What about him?
If we knew what made Ishigura behave as he did, we'd understand this case.
I don't understand.
It's hard for an American to see him clearly, Connor said. Because in America, you think a certain amount of error is normal. You expect the plane to be late. You expect the mail to be undelivered. You expect the washing machine to break down. You expect things to go wrong all the time. But Japan is different. Everything works in Japan. In a Tokyo train station, you can stand at a marked spot on the platform, and when the train stops, the doors will open right in front of you. Trains are on time. Bags are not lost. Connections are not missed. Deadlines are met. Things happen as planned. The Japanese are educated, prepared, and motivated. They get things done. There's no screwing around.
Uh-huh.
And tonight was a very big night for the Nakamoto Corporation. You can be sure they planned everything down to the smallest detail. They have the vegetarian hors d'oeuvres that Madonna likes and the photographer she prefers. Believe me, they're prepared. They have planned for every exigency. You know how they are.
They sit around and discuss endless possibilities. What if there's a fire? What if there's an earthquake? A bomb scare? Power failure? Endlessly going over the most unlikely events. It's obsessive, but when the final night arrives, they've thought of everything and they're in complete control. It's very bad form not to be in control. Okay? Okay. But there is our friend Ishigara, the official representative of Nakamoto, standing in front of a dead girl, and he's clearly not in control. He's Yoshiki no, doing Western-style confrontation, but he isn't comfortable. I'm sure you noticed the sweat on his lip. And his hand is damp. He keeps wiping it on his trousers. He is Rikutsupoi, too argumentative. He's talking too much. In short, he's behaving as if he doesn't really know what to do, as if he doesn't even know who this girl is. Which he certainly does, since he knows everybody invited to that party. And pretending he doesn't know who killed her, when he almost certainly knows that, too. The car bounced in a pothole and jolted back up. Wait a minute. Ishigara knows who killed the girl? I'm sure of it. And he's not the only one. At least three people must know who killed her at this point. Didn't you say you used to be in press relations? Yes, last year. You keep any contacts in TV news? A few, I said. They might be rusty. Why? I want to look at some tape that was shot tonight. Just look, not subpoena? Right, just look. That shouldn't be a problem, I said. I was thinking I could call Jennifer Lewis at KNBC or Bob Arthur at KCBS. Probably Bob. Connor said, it has to be somebody you can approach personally. Otherwise, the stations won't help us. You notice there were no TV crews at the crime scene tonight. At most crime scenes, you have to fight your way past the cameras just to get to the tape. But tonight, no TV crews, no reporters, nothing. I shrugged. We were on landlines. The press couldn't monitor radio transmissions. They were already there, Connor said, covering the party with Tom Cruise and Madonna. And then a girl gets murdered on the floor above. So where were the TV crews? I said, Captain, I don't buy it. One of the things I learned as a press officer is that there aren't any conspiracies. The press is too diverse, and in a sense too disorganized. In fact, on the rare occasions when we needed an embargo, like a kidnapping with ransom negotiations in progress, we had a hell of a time getting cooperation. The paper closes early. The TV crews have to make the 11 o'clock news. They probably went back to edit their stories. I disagree. I think the Japanese expressed concern about their shafu, their company image, and the press cooperated with no coverage. Trust me, Kohai. The pressure is being applied. I can't believe that. Take my word for it, Connor said. The pressure is on. Just then the car phone rang. God damn it, Peter, a familiar rough voice said. What the fuck's going on with that homicide investigation? It was the chief. It sounded like he had been drinking. How do you mean, chief? Connor looked at me and punched the speakerphone button so he could hear. The chief said, You guys harassing the Japanese? We going to have another set of racial allegations against the department here? No, sir, I said. Absolutely not. I don't know what you've heard. I heard that dumb fuck Graham was making insults as usual, the chief said. Well, I wouldn't exactly say insults, chief. Look, Peter, don't shit me. I already reamed out Fred Hoffman for sending Graham in the first place. I want that racist turd off the case. We've all got to get along with the Japanese from now on. It's the way the world is. You hearing me, Peter? Yes, sir. Now about John Connor. You got him with you, is that right? Yes, sir. Why did you bring him into this? I thought, why did I bring him in? Fred Hoffman must have decided to say that Connor was my idea and not his own. I'm sorry, I said, but I understand, the chief said. You probably thought you couldn't handle the case yourself, wanted some help.
but I'm afraid you bought more trouble than help, because the Japanese don't like Connor. And I got to tell you, I go way back with John. We entered the academy together back in 59. He's always been a loner and a troublemaker. You know, anybody who goes to live in some foreign country, it's because he can't fit in here at home. I don't want him screwing up this investigation now. Chief, this is how I see it, Peter. You got a homicide here. Wrap it up and get it over with. Do it quick and do it neat. I'm looking to you and you alone. You hearing me? Yes, sir. The connection is good? Yes, sir, I said. Wrap it up, Pete, the chief said. I don't want anybody else calling me on this. Yes, sir. Finish it by tomorrow latest. That's it. And he hung up. I put the phone back in the cradle. Yes, Connor said. I'd say pressure is being applied. I drove south on the 405 freeway toward the airport. It was foggier here. Connor stared out the window. In a Japanese organization, you'd never get a call like that. The chief just hung you out to dry. He takes no responsibility. It's all your problem. And he's blaming you for things that have nothing to do with you, like Graham and me. Connor shook his head. The Japanese don't do that. The Japanese have a saying, fix the problem, not the blame. In American organizations, it's all about who fucked up, whose head will roll. In Japanese organizations, it's about what's fucked up and how to fix it. Nobody gets blamed. Their way is better. Connor was silent, staring out the window. We were driving past Slauson, the Marina Freeway, a dark curve arcing above us in the fog. I said, the chief was in the bag, that's all. Yes, and uninformed, as usual. But even so, it sounds like we'd better have this case solved before he gets out of bed tomorrow. Can we do that? Yes, if Ishigara delivers those tapes. The phone rang again. I answered it. It was Ishigara. I handed the phone to Connor. I could hear Ishigara faintly through the receiver. He sounded tense, speaking rapidly. Oshimoshi, Connor-san. Watashi wa kibi no heya ni denwa. Oshimashita ka. Dare mo damasen deshita. Connor cupped his hand over the phone and translated. He called the security guard, but no one was there. Sore de chuoke bishitsu ni renrakashite. Ito okutemurai. Ishoni ita tepu. Okakenin shimashita. Then he called the main security office and asked them to come down with him to check the tapes. Tepe wa sebeta rekoda no nakeni arimasu. Nakunatemo. Torika era retamo imasen. Sebeta daijobu desu. The tapes are all in the recorders. No tapes are missing or switched. Connor frowned and replied, Ia, tepu wa surikara rarate iru hazananda. Tepu osagase. Sebeta daijobu nandes, Connor-san. Doshiro to io no deska. He insists everything is in order. Connor said, Tepu osagase. To me, he said, I told him I wanted the damn tapes. Daijobu da iteranoni. Doshite sonani tepu osagase to osharun deska. Oreni wa wakata irunda. Tepu wa nakanata iru. I know more than you think, Mr. Ishigara. Moichido yu tepu o sagasanda.
Connor banged the phone in the cradle and sat back, snorting angrily. Bastards. They're taking the position that there are no missing tapes.
What does that mean?
I said. They've decided to play hardball. Connor stared out the window at the traffic and tapped his teeth with his finger.
They'd never do it unless they felt they had a strong position, an unassailable position, which means...
Connor drifted off into his private thoughts. I saw his face intermittently reflected in the glass under passing street lamps. Finally, he said,
No, no, no,
as if he were talking to someone.
No what?
It can't be Graham.
He shook his head.
Graham is too risky. Too many ghosts from the past.
And it's not me either. I'm old news.
So it must be you, Peter.
I said, what are you talking about?
Something has happened, Connor said, to make Ishigura think he has leverage. And I'd guess it's something to do with you.
Me? Yeah, it's almost certainly something personal. You have any problems in your past?
Like what?
Any priors, arrests, internal affairs investigations, allegations of questionable conduct like drinking or homosexuality or chasing women? Any drug rehab program, problems with partners, problems with superiors? Anything, personal or professional. Anything. I shrugged.
Jeez, I don't think so.
Connor just waited, looking at me. Finally, he said,
they think they have something, Peter.
I'm divorced. I'm a single parent. I have a daughter, Michelle. She's 2 years old.
Yes.
I lead a quiet life. I take care of my kid. I'm responsible.
And your wife?
My ex-wife is a lawyer in the DA's office.
When did you get divorced?
2 years ago.
Before the child was born?
Just after.
Why did you get divorced?
Christ, why does anybody get divorced? Connor said nothing. We were only married a year. She was young when we met, 24. She had these fantasies about things. We met in court. She thought I was a rough, tough detective facing danger every day. She liked that I had a gun, all that. So we had this affair. Then when she got pregnant, she didn't want to have an abortion. She wanted to get married instead. It was some romantic idea she had. She didn't really think it through. But the pregnancy was hard, and it was too late to abort. And pretty soon she decided she didn't like living with me because my apartment was small and I didn't make enough money, and I lived in Culver City instead of Brentwood. And by the time the baby was finally born, it was like she was completely disillusioned. She said she had made a mistake. She wanted to pursue her career. She didn't want to be married to a cop. She didn't want to raise a kid. She said she was sorry, but it was all a mistake. And she left. Connor was listening with his eyes closed. Yes?
I don't see why all this matters. She left 2 years ago. And after that, I didn't want to work detective hours anymore, because now I had to raise the kid, so I took the tests and transferred to special services, and I worked the press office. No problems there. Everything went fine. Then last year this Asian liaison job came up, and it paid better. Another couple hundred a month. So I applied for that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I can really use the money. I have extra expenses now, like Michelle's daycare. You know what daycare costs for two-year-olds? And I have full-time housekeeping, and Lauren doesn't make her child support payments more than half the time. She says she can't manage on her salary, but she just bought a new BMW, so I don't know. I mean, what am I going to do, take her to court? She works for the fucking DA.
Connor was silent. Up ahead, I saw the airplanes coming down over the freeway. We were approaching the airport.
Anyway, I said, I was glad when the liaison job came along, because it works out better for the hours and for the money. And that's how I got to be here, in this car with you. That's it.
Kohai, he said quietly, we're in this together. Just tell me, what is the problem?
There isn't any problem.
Kohai.
There isn't.
Kohai.
Hey, John, I said, let me tell you something. When you apply for special services liaison, 5 different committees go over your record. To get a liaison job, you have to be clean. The committees went over my record, and they found nothing substantial.
Connor nodded. But they found something.
Christ, I said. I was a detective for 5 years. You can't work that long without a few complaints. You know that.
And what were the complaints against you?
I shook my head. Nothing. Little stuff. I arrested a guy my first year. He accused me of undue force. That charge was dropped after inquiry. I arrested a woman for armed robbery. She claimed I planted a gram on her. Charge dropped. It was her gram. Murder suspect claimed I beat and kicked him during questioning.
but other officers were present at all times. A drunken woman on a domestic violence call later claimed I molested her child. She dropped the charge. Teenage gang leader arrested for murder said I made a homosexual pass at him. Charge withdrawn. That's it. If you're a cop, you know that complaints like these are background noise, like traffic on the street. There's nothing you can do about them. You're in an adversarial environment, accusing people of crimes all the time. They accuse you back. That's just the way it works. The department never pays any attention unless there's a pattern or repetition. If a guy has 3 or 4 complaints of undue force over a couple of years, then he gets an inquiry. Or a string of racial complaints. He gets an inquiry. But otherwise, as the assistant chief, Jim Olson, always says, being a cop is a job for the thick-skinned. Connor didn't say anything for a long time. He frowned, thinking it over. Finally, he said, "What about the divorce? Problems there?" "Nothing unusual." "You and your ex are on speaking terms?" "Yes, we're okay. Not great, but okay." He was still frowning, still looking for something. "And you left the detective division 2 years ago?" "Yes." "Why?" "I already told you. You said that you couldn't work the hours." "That was most of it, yeah." "That? And what else?" I shrugged. After the divorce, I just didn't want to work homicide anymore. I felt like, I don't know, disillusioned. I had this little infant, and my wife had moved out. She was going on with her life, dating some hotshot attorney. I was left holding the kid. I just felt flat. I didn't want to be a detective anymore. "You seek counseling at that time? Therapy?" "No." "Trouble with drugs or alcohol?" "No." "Other women?" "Some." "During the marriage?" I hesitated. "Farley? In the mayor's office?" "No, that was later." "But there was somebody during the marriage." "Yes, but she lives in Phoenix now. Her husband got transferred."
"She was in the department?"
I shrugged. Connor sat back in his seat. "Okay, Kohai," he said. "If this is all there is, you're fine." He looked at me. "That's all. But I have to warn you," he said. "I've been through this kind of thing before with the Japanese. When the Japanese play hardball, they can make things unpleasant. Really unpleasant." "You trying to scare me?"
"No, just telling you the way things are."
"Fuck the Japanese," I said. "I've got nothing to hide."
"Fine. Now I think you better call your friends at the network and tell them we'll be over after our next stop."
A 747 roared low overhead, its landing lights flaring in the fog. It passed the sputtering neon sign that read, "Girls, girls, all nude, girls." It was around 11:30 when we went inside. To call the Club Palomino a strip joint was to flatter it. It was a converted bowling alley with cactus and horses painted on the walls. It seemed smaller inside than it appeared from the outside. A woman in a silver tasseled G-string, who looked close to 40, danced listlessly in orange light. She seemed as bored as the customers hunched over tiny pink tables. Topless waitresses moved through the smoky air. The tape-recorded music had a loud hiss. A guy just inside the door said, $12, 2-drink minimum." Connor flipped his badge. The guy said, "Okay, fine." Connor looked around and said, "I didn't know Japanese came here." I saw 3 businessmen in blue suits sitting at a corner table. "Hardly ever," the bouncer said. "They like the Star Strip downtown. More glitz, more tits. You ask me, those guys got lost from their tour." Connor nodded. "I'm looking for Ted Cole."
"At the bar, guy with the glasses."
Ted Cole was sitting at the bar. His windbreaker covered his Nakamoto security uniform. He stared at us dully when we came up and sat beside him. The bartender came over. Connor said, "2 buds."
"No bud. Asahi okay?"
"Okay." Connor flipped his badge. Cole shook his head and turned away from us. He looked studiously at the stripper.
"I don't know anything."
Connor said, "About what?"
About anything. I'm just minding my own business. I'm off duty.
He was a little drunk.
Connor said, When did you get off duty?
I got off early tonight.
Why is that?
Stomach trouble. I got an ulcer. It acts up sometimes. So I got off early.
What time?
I got off at 8:15 at the latest.
Do you punch a time clock?
No, we don't do that. No time clock.
And who took over for you?
I got relieved.
By whom?
My supervisor.
Who is that?
I don't know him. Japanese guy. Never seen him before.
He's your supervisor, and you never saw him before?
New guy. Japanese. I don't know him. What do you want from me, anyway?
Just to ask a few questions, Connor said.
I got nothing to hide, Cole said.
One of the Japanese men sitting at the table came up to the bar. He stood near us and said to the bartender,
What kind of cigarettes you got?
Marlboro, the bartender said.
What else?
Maybe Cools. I'll have to check. But I know we got Marlboro. You want Marlboro?
Ted Cole stared at the Japanese man. The Japanese seemed not to notice him as he stood at the bar.
Kent, the Japanese said. You got any Kent lights?
No, no Kent.
Okay, then, Marlboro, the Japanese man said. Marlboro is okay.
He turned and smiled at us.
This is Marlboro country, right?
That's right, Connor said.
Cole picked up his beer and sipped it. We were all silent. The Japanese man beat the bar with his hands in time to the music.
Great place, he said. A lot of atmosphere.
I wondered what he was talking about. This place was a dump. The Japanese slid onto the bar stool next to us. Cole studied his beer bottle as if he'd never seen one before. He turned it in his hands, making rings on the bar top. The bartender brought cigarettes, and the Japanese man tossed a $5 bill on the table.
Keep the change.
He tore open the pack and took out a cigarette. He smiled at us. Connor took out his lighter to light the man's cigarette. As the man leaned over the flame, he said,
Doko kaisha iteno?
The man blinked.
Sorry?
Wakane no? Connor said. Doko kaisha iteno?
The man smiled and slipped off the bar stool.
Soro soro ikanakata wa. Shiture shimasu.
He gave a little wave and he went back to his friends across the room.
Dewamata,
Connor said. He moved around to sit on the stool where the Japanese man had been sitting. Cole said,
What was that all about?
I just asked him what company he worked for, Connor said, but he didn't want to talk. I guess he wanted to get back to his friends.
Connor ran his hands under the bar, feeling,
Feels clean.
Connor turned back to Cole and said,
Now then, Mr. Cole, you were telling me that a supervisor took over for you. At what time was that?
8:15.
And you didn't know him?
No.
And before that time, while you were on duty, were you taping from the video cameras?
Sure, the security office always tapes from the cameras.
And did the supervisor remove the tapes?
Remove them?
I don't think so. The tapes are still there, as far as I know.
He looked at us in a puzzled way.
You fellows are interested in the tapes?
Yes, Connor said.
Because I never paid much attention to the tapes. I was interested in the cameras.
How's that?
They were getting the building ready for the big party, and there were lots of last-minute details. But you still had to wonder why they pulled so many security cameras off other parts of the building and put them up on that floor.
I said, They what?
Those cameras weren't on the 46th floor yesterday morning, Cole said. They were scattered all around the building. Somebody moved them during the day. They're easy to move, you know, because there's no wires attached.
The cameras have no wires?
No, it's all cellular transmission inside the building itself. Built that way. That's why they don't have audio or color. They can't transmit the full bandwidth on cellular, so they just send an image. But they can move those cameras around to suit their purposes, see whatever they want to see. You didn't know that?
No, I said.
I'm surprised nobody told you. It's one of the features of the building they're most proud of.
Cole drank his beer.
Only question I have is why somebody would take 5 cameras and install them on the floor above the party. Because there's no security reason. You can lock off the elevators above a certain floor. So for security, you'd want your cameras on the floors below the party, not above.
But the elevators weren't locked off.
No, I thought that was kind of unusual myself.
He looked at the Japanese across the room.
I got to be going soon, he said.
Well, Connor said, you've been very helpful, Mr. Cole. We may want to question you again.
I'll write down my phone number for you,
Cole said, scribbling on a bar napkin.
And your address?
Yeah, right. But actually, I'm going out of town for a few days. My mother's been feeling sick, and she asked me to take her down there to Mexico for a few days. Probably go this weekend.
Long trip?
Week or so. I've got vacation days coming up. It seems like a good time to take it.
Sure, Connor said. I can see how it would. Thanks again for your help.
He shook hands with Cole and punched him lightly on the shoulder.
And you take care of your health.
Oh, I will.
Stop drinking and have a safe drive home.
He paused.
Or wherever you may decide to go tonight instead.
Cole nodded.
I think you're right. That's not a bad idea.
I know I'm right.
Cole shook my hand. Connor was heading out the door. Cole said,
I don't know why you guys are bothering.
With the tapes?
With the Japanese. What can you do? They're ahead of us every step of the way, and they have the big guys in their pocket. We can't beat them now. You two guys will never beat them. They're just too good.
Outside, beneath the crackling neon sign, Connor said,
Come on, time is wasting.
We got in the car. He handed me the bar napkin. On it was scrawled in block letters, They stole the tapes.
Let's get going, Connor said.
I started the car.
The 11 o'clock news was finished for the night, and the newsroom was nearly deserted. Connor and I went down the hall to the sound stage where the action news set was still lit up. On the set, the evening broadcast was being replayed with the sound off. The anchorman pointed to the monitor. I'm not stupid, Bobby. I watch these things. She did the lead-in and the wrap-up the last 3 nights. He sat back in his chair and crossed his arms. I'm waiting to hear what you have to say, Bobby. My friend Bob Arthur, the heavy-set, tired producer of the 11 o'clock news, sipped a tumbler of straight scotch as big as his fist. He said, Jim, it just worked out that way.
Worked out that way, my ass, the anchorman said.
The anchor woman was a gorgeous redhead with a killer figure. She was taking a long time to shuffle through her notes, making sure she stayed to overhear the conversation between Bob and her co-anchor. Look, the anchorman said, it's in my contract, half the lead-ins and half the wraps. It's contractual.
But Jim, the producer said, the lead tonight was Paris Fashions and the Nakamoto Party. That's human interest stuff.
It should have been the serial killer. Bob sighed.
His arraignment was postponed. Anyway, the public is tired of serial killers.
The anchorman looked incredulous. The public is tired of serial killers? Now, where'd you get that?
You can read it yourself in the focus groups, Jim. Serial killers are overexposed. Our audience is worried about the economy. They don't want any more serial killers.
Our audience is worried about the economy, so we lead off with Nakamoto and Paris Fashions?
That's right, Jim, Bob Arthur said. In hard times, you do star parties. That's what people want to see. Fashion and fantasy.
The anchor looked sullen. I'm a journalist. I'm here to do hard news, not fashion.
Right, Jim, the producer said. That's why Liz did the intros tonight. We want to keep your image hard news.
When Teddy Roosevelt led this country out of the Great Depression, he didn't do it with fashion and fantasy.
Franklin Roosevelt.
Whatever. You know what I'm saying. If people are worried, let's do the economy. Let's do the balance of payments or whatever it is.
Right, Jim. But this is the 11 o'clock news in the local market, and people don't want to hear.
And that's what's wrong with America, the anchorman pronounced, stabbing the air with his finger. People don't want to hear the real news.
Right, Jim. You're absolutely right.
He put his arm over the anchorman's shoulder.
Get some rest, okay? We'll talk tomorrow.
That seemed to be a signal of some kind, because the anchor woman finished with her notes and strode off. I'm a journalist, the anchor said. I just want to do the job I was trained for.
Right, Jim. More tomorrow. Have a good night.
Stupid dickhead, Bob Arthur said, leading us down a corridor.
Teddy Roosevelt. Jesus. They're not journalists. They're actors. And they count their lines, like all actors.
He sighed and took another drink of scotch.
Now tell me again, what do you guys want to see?
Tape from the Nakamoto opening.
You mean the air tapes? The story we ran tonight?
No, we want to see the original footage from the camera.
The field tapes? Geez, I hope we still have them. They may have been bulked.
Bulked?
Bulked degaussed. Erased. We shoot 40 cassettes a day here. Most of them get erased right away. We used to save field tapes for a week, but we're cutting costs, you know.
On one side of the newsroom were shelves of stacked Betamax cartridges. Bob ran his finger along the boxes.
Nakamoto, Nakamoto. No, I don't see them.
A woman went past.
Cindy, is Rick still here?
No, he's gone home. You need something?
The Nakamoto field tapes, they aren't on the shelf.
Check Don's room. He cut it.
Okay.
Bob led us across the newsroom to the editing bays on the far side. He opened a door, and we entered a small, messy room with two monitors, several tape decks, and an editing console. Tapes and boxes were scattered around the floor. Bob rummaged through them.
Okay, you guys are in luck. Camera originals. There's a lot of it. I'll get Jenny to run you through them. She's our best spotter. She knows everybody.
He stuck his head out the door.
Jenny? Jenny.
Okay, let's see, Jenny Gonzalez said a few minutes later.
She was a bespectacled, heavy-set woman in her 40s. She scanned the editor's notes and frowned.
It doesn't matter how many times I tell them. They just will not put things in proper... Finally, here we are. Four tapes. Two limo drive-ups. Two roving inside at the party. What do you want to see?
Connor said,
Start with the drive-ups.
He glanced at his watch. Is there any way to do this fast? We're in a hurry.
Fast as you want. I'm used to it. Let's see it at high speed.
She hit a button. At high speed, we saw the limousines pulling up, the doors jumping open, the people getting out, jerkily walking away.
Looking for anyone in particular? Because I see somebody marked footages for celebrities during the edit.
We're not looking for a celebrity, I said.
Too bad. It's probably all we shot.
We watched the tape. Jenny said,
There's Senator Kennedy. He's lost some weight, hasn't he?
Oops, gone. And Senator Morton, looking very fit. No surprise. That creepy assistant of his, he makes my teeth shiver.
Senator Rowe, without his wife, as usual. There's Tom Hanks. I don't know this Japanese guy. Connor said, Arata Masagawa, Vice President of Mitsui.
There you go. Senator Chalmers, hair transplant looking good. Congressman Levine. Congressman Daniels. Sober for a change. You know, I'm surprised Nakamoto got so many of these Washington people to attend.
Why do you say that?
Well, when you get down to it, it's just the opening of some new building. An ordinary corporate bash. It's on the West Coast, and Nakamoto is pretty controversial right at the moment. Barbara Streisand. I don't know who the guy is with her.
Nakamoto was controversial?
Why? Because of the Microcon sale.
I said, What's Microcon?
Microcon is an American company that makes computer equipment. A Japanese company named Akai Ceramics is trying to buy it. There's opposition to the sale in Congress because of worries about America losing technology to Japan.
I said, And what does this have to do with Nakamoto?
Nakamoto is the parent company of Akai.
The first tape finished and popped out.
Nothing there you wanted?
No, let's go on.
Right.
She slid the second tape in.
Anyway, I'm surprised how many of these senators and congressmen felt it was acceptable to show up here tonight.
Okay, here we go. More drive-ups.
Roger Hillerman, Under Secretary of State for Pacific Affairs. That's his assistant with him.
Kenichi Heiko, Consul General of Japan, here in L.A. Richard Meyer, architect, works for Getty. Don't know her. Some Japanese.
Connor said, Hisashi Konawa, Vice President of Honda, U.S.
Oh, yeah,
Jenny said. He's been here about 3 years now. Probably going home soon.
That's Edna Morris. She heads the U.S. delegation to the GATT talks. You know, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. I can't believe she showed up here. It's an obvious conflict of interest. But there she is, all smiling and relaxed. Chuck Norris, Eddie Sakamura, sort of a local playboy. Don't know the girl with him. Tom Cruise with his Australian wife. And Madonna, of course.
On the accelerated tape, the strobes flashed almost continuously as Madonna stepped from her limousine and preened.
Want to slow it down? You interested in this?
Connor said, not tonight.
Well, we probably have a lot on her, Jenny said.
She pushed the very high speed fast forward and the image streaked gray. When she punched back, Madonna was wiggling toward the elevator, leaning on the arm of a slender Hispanic boy with a mustache. The image blurred as the camera swung back toward the street. Then it stabilized again.
There's Daniel Okimoto, expert on Japanese industrial policy. That's Arnold with Maria. And behind them is Steve Martin with Arato Isozaki, the architect who designed the museum.
Connor said, wait. She punched the console button. The picture froze. Jenny seemed surprised.
You're interested in Isozaki?
No. Back up, please. The tape ran backward, the frames flicking and blurring as the camera panned off Steve Martin and went back to record the next arrival from the limousines. But for a moment in the pan, the camera swung past a group of people who had already gotten out of their limousines and were walking up the carpeted sidewalk. Connor said, there. The image froze. Slightly blurred, I saw a tall blonde in a black cocktail dress walking forward alongside a handsome man in a dark suit.
Huh, Jenny said. You interested in him or her?
Her.
Let me think, Jenny said, frowning. I've seen her at parties with the Washington types for about 9 months now. She's this year's Kelly Emberg, the athletic, modely kind. But sophisticated. Sort of a Tatiana look-alike. Her name is Austin. Cindy Austin. Carrie Austin. Cheryl Austin. That's it.
I said, you know anything else about her? Jenny shook her head. Listen, I think getting a name is pretty good. These girls show up all the time. You see a new one everywhere for 6 months, a year, and then they're gone. God knows where they go. Who can keep track of them?
And the man with her?
Richard Levitt, plastic surgeon, does a lot of big stars.
What's he doing here?
She shrugged. He's around. Like a lot of these guys, he's a companion to the stars in their time of need. If his patients are getting divorced or whatever, he escorts the woman. When he's not taking out clients, he takes out models like her. They certainly look good together. On the monitor, Cheryl and her escort walked toward us in intermittent jerks. One frame every 30 seconds, stepping slow. I noticed they never looked at each other. She seemed tense, expectant. Jenny Gonzalez said, so, plastic surgeon and a model. Can I ask what's the big deal about these two? Because at an evening like this, they're just, you know, party favors.
Connor said, she was killed tonight.
Oh, she's the one?
Interesting.
I said, you've heard about the murder?
Oh, sure.
Was it on the news?
No, didn't make the 11 o'clock, Jenny said. And it probably won't be on tomorrow. I can't see it myself. It's not really a story.
Why is that? I asked, glancing at Connor. Well, what's the peg?
I don't follow you.
Nakamoto would say it's only news because it happened at their opening. They'd take the position that any reporting of it is a smear on them. But in a way, they're right. I mean, if this girl got killed on the freeway, it wouldn't make the news. If she got killed in a convenience store robbery, it wouldn't make the news. We have two or three of those every night. So the fact that she gets killed at a party, who cares? It's still not news. She's young and pretty, but she's not special. It's not as if she has a series or anything. Connor glanced at his watch. Shall we look at the other tapes?
The footage from the party? Sure. You looking for this particular girl?
Right.
Okay, here we go.
Jenny put in the third tape. We saw scenes from the party on the 45th floor. The swing band, people dancing beneath the hanging decorations. We strained for a glimpse of the girl in the crowd. Jenny said, "In Japan, we wouldn't have to do this by eye. The Japanese have pretty sophisticated video recognition software now. They have a program where you identify an image, say a face, and it'll automatically search tape for you and find every instance of that face. Find it in a crowd or wherever it appears. Has the ability to see a single view of a three-dimensional object and then to recognize the same object in other views. It's supposed to be pretty nifty, but slow."
I'm surprised the station hasn't got it.
Oh, it's not for sale here. The most advanced Japanese video equipment isn't available in this country. They keep us 3 to 5 years behind, which is their privilege. It's their technology. They can do what they want.
But it'd sure be useful in a case like this.
The party images were streaming past, a frenetic blur. Suddenly, she locked the image.
There. Background camera left. Your Austin girl's talking to Eddie Sakamura.
Of course, he'd know her. Sakamura knows all the models.
Normal speed here?
Please, Connor said, staring at the screen. The camera made a slow pan around the room. Cheryl Austin remained in view for most of the shot, laughing with Eddie Sakamura, throwing her head back, resting her hand on his arm, happy to be with him. Eddie clowned for her, his face mobile. He seemed to enjoy making her laugh. But from time to time, her eyes flicked away, glancing around the room, as if she was waiting for something to happen, or for someone to arrive. At one point, Sakamura became aware he did not have her full attention. He grabbed her arm and pulled her roughly toward him. She turned her face away from him. He leaned close to her and said something angrily. Then a bald man stepped forward, very close to the camera. The light flared on his face, washing out his features, and his head blocked our view of Eddie and the girl. Then the camera panned left, and we lost them.
Damn.
Again? Jenny backed it up, and we ran it once more. I said,
Eddie's obviously not happy with her.
I'd say. Connor frowned.
It's so difficult to know what we are seeing. You have sound for this?
Jenny said, sure, but it's probably Walla. She punched buttons and ran it again. The track was continuous cocktail party din. Only for brief moments did we hear an isolated phrase. At one point, Cheryl Austin looked at Eddie Sakamura and said,
can't help if it's important to you, I get.
His reply to her was garbled, but later he said clearly to her,
don't understand. All about the Saturday meeting.
And in the last few seconds of the pan, when he pulled her to him, he snarled a phrase like,
be a fool, no cheapy.
I said,
did he say no cheapy?
Something like that, Connor said.
Jenny said, want to run it again?
No, Connor said. There's nothing more to be learned here. Go forward.
Right, Jenny said. The image accelerated, the partygoers becoming frenetic, laughing and raising glasses for quick sips. And then I said,
wait.
Back to normal speed. A blonde woman in an Armani silk suit shaking hands with the bald-headed man we had seen a few moments before.
What is it?
Jenny said, looking at me.
That's his wife, Connor said.
End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.